welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
Drew Brenneman joins me here tonight, and you can find what his team is up to by going to Brenneman.com. I can't believe you managed to get your last name as your domain name, but Brenneman.com. That's going to be a clickable link, of course, in the show notes. Really appreciate your time, Drew, as we talk about what your company is up to in these multifamily space.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Yeah, thanks for having me. And if you pay someone enough money, you can have your the domain of your last name as well. So yeah, I bought it off someone for a pretty penny who told me he went to Stanford in the 80s and had it registered since like 1990. So wasn't an easy guy to get it from.
But just was squatting on it.
Yeah, he said he might use it someday for like a charity or something. You know, he had the same last name as me, but you know, hadn't been using it. Thankfully, I mean, it would have been more money probably if he was using it too. But yeah, I was happy to be able to get that domain. So
I know you're in the multifamily space and you're working on some pretty large projects. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because I'm sure you've spent a considerable amount of time already on other shows, kind of giving your background, but it's always interesting to hear your investment journey and how you found your way to your current investment platform.
Yeah. I mean, I started out in 2005 and I bought my first duplex when I was 19. You know, I had started an internet business in high school and made some money doing that where I was buying and selling items in online video games. And, you know, I didn't make a lot of money on any one transaction, you know, like $5 or $10. I was reselling things for $10, $15, $20. But I did thousands of them. Like on eBay, I had over 5,000 positive feedback, you know, from every, you know, of doing one at a time. And so, yeah, I had made that money, was looking at what to do with it. And yeah, I didn't have anyone really like in my life, so to speak, that was like a business person. My parents were both teachers, didn't have any relatives that did any business type stuff. Everyone just had a job. And so I started reading books about business and investing in high school, like the ones that probably most people read when they're like 40, like Rich Dad Poor Dad and Intelligent Investor. And I did a book report on Think and Grow Rich. But I really liked what I was reading in these real estate books, is how you combined an investment and a business essentially, and had all these different ways you could make money. And you know, the stuff you and I'm sure the listeners already know about, like cash flow and paying the loan down and tax breaks. So I liked it, and I decided, why don't I buy my first property when I go to college? And I went to college at UW-Madison, and then I bought two duplexes when I was 19. The first one for $216,000 and the next one for $300,000+. So not huge deals, but was able to, you know, use the money that I had made to put down on those. And then the next couple of deals I bought were closer to no money down. Three units that I bought, each for like around $700,000, and then graduated and went up to Minnesota. And that's where I met my first investor when I was working full time at a developer. And then we were sort of, you know, if we want a quicker version of that, you know, then over the next 10 years, we bought $100 million of property together, me, him, and his son, throughout Minnesota and Chicago, which I had relocated to later on for a different job. And then I eventually went full time with this as we accumulated a big enough portfolio. And then I started picking up other investors and have about $235 million of property today. So just kind of started small and then got, you know, pretty big. And here we are.
So talk about your business today. Is it primarily syndication, or how do you structure your newest acquisitions?
Yeah, they're syndications, but also we do target, you know, family offices, fund of funds, just larger investors. You know, the last deal that we bought was $18.5 million apartment building in the West Loop neighborhood of Chicago. And like the equity on that, it was, you know, half the money came from just one family office, and then the rest was 22 different investors on that. And so just kind of a mix. And then I think we also have been chasing around some bigger deals that would be $10 million plus equity checks. And then for those, we've been taking them just to family offices that can just write that kind of check. And then I think our investors that we've had in our deals that invest, you know, $50,000 or $100,000, they would come in just alongside us on the co-GP investment as well. So, and then in terms of what we're targeting, you know, so yeah, when I started out, I was buying all sorts of different product types, but really around 2013, I started specializing in multifamily, you know, for a lot of reasons, just has the best debt availability. You know, I really like the 1 year leases where you don't have to re-rent it every day, like a hotel or month to month, like self storage, but you can, as you know, things are improving, you can raise the rents quick enough compared to our commercial deals where we were locked in there, you know, 5 or 10 year leases. And then I had identified a really nice niche where we were buying newer properties, you know, usually stuff that has been built since 2005 till today, but where the rents are below market and maybe there needs to be some renovation, like simple CapEx, but nothing like a gut rehab since it's still a newer, nicer building. But oftentimes we're ripping out carpet and putting in vinyl and upgrading the appliances and painting everything a different color. But yeah, we found good, you know, really good footing with that strategy. I've done 14 full cash out refis. So acquire the property, raise the rents, and then put a new loan on the property and return all the equity. So I think that strategy, you know, that we've liked that, or we recycled the same sort of pool of capital with that. I think, you know, you probably don't want to have every deal that way, because once you add the value, you're re-levering the property up. So we do have like a relatively high debt load on those, but they're all fixed rate. And we did that back when rates were in the threes and low four. So those deals are doing quite well, but, you know, it would probably be, you know, so I like to have a mix. So then a lot of the other deals, we haven't done any cash out refis, and those are similar business plans, but then, you know, we're just not pulling out additional money. We're planning on just holding it for, you know, 10 years or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. You're talking about a lot of stuff there to unpack. The increasing of the rents, for example, you must be acquiring some properties. Are they typically mom and pop type situations where they're just undervaluing the rentals, or where are you finding these opportunities?
It's been I guess it's kind of shifted over time. So like in 2013, it would have looked like it was a building that was built to be sold as condos, but it went back to the bank, you know, let's say in 2010 or 11, and as a foreclosure. And then we, you know, someone acquired the note, and then we went and got a hold of the property to buying it from whoever foreclosed the owner out. But they then maximized the operation. So then we were able to go in and raise the rents where the prior owner just got it so cheaply with their strategy. There was still a lot of meat on the bone. And then those deals started drying up in maybe call like 2015. And then all the deals, let's say from 2015 to 2019, they were either off market, you know, like from someone that I knew in the market. So like a property management company or another owner. And so then we, you know, we were buying them at really good prices, given it was a direct deal. So, you know, we were saving on brokerage fees. And then also usually there still was some meat on the bone, but maybe not. You're making it up on the price. And then we bought quite a few deals from developers where they built the building, they do their lease up, but then they didn't really hit the market rents. Like they had to rent out so many units in such a short period of time, they didn't get really like full max rents, where they would need to bring it through another leasing cycle for another year or two to really maximize the rents. And instead of doing that, they opted to sell. And then loan assumption deals. So we've done 5 or 6, I think, at this point. And this is before, you know, loan assumptions now today, it's like, it's an obvious strategy where the rates are lower on most of those deals. You know, if you're assuming a loan that was originated in 2019 or 20 or 21, you know, rates were lower then. But we were doing these mostly in 2018, 19, and 20. We did do one last year, but the ones, except for the one last year, the reason we did it was we were getting it at a really attractive price. The seller had a yield maintenance loan on it. They couldn't sell without someone taking the loan. The loan on, and then, you know, so we just made an offer that worked for us, and then they had, you know, so few bids on it, you know, having to assume like a 5% interest loan, that the numbers look great for us. So it's been a wide variety of different deals.
So the loan assumption thing, that's kind of starting to dry up as well now, is that?
Well, really more what I was getting at is, let's say if you did a loan assumption deal in, let's say, 2020, what that probably looked like is somebody financed the property in maybe 2018 when rates were in the fives and five. Mm-hmm. So let's say it's 5.5% was the rate. And then rates dropped into the threes. So now they go sell this property and they have, let's say, have a yield maintenance loan on it. They might have a 20% prepayment penalty, 20% of the outstanding loan balance. So it's a, one of the deals we did in 2020, we bought it for $13 million and assumed a 10 something million dollar loan. Their prepay penalty would have been $2 million. So they basically, we only can sell it to someone assuming the loan. But what I was saying is why that was the opportunity. It just felt different basically then was we were buying it cheap enough where a 5.5% rate made sense. Whereas last year when we did a loan assumption, it was the opposite. We're paying basically what would be market pricing for the in-place rents, but we're assuming a 4.6% interest rate loan when market at that time was, you know, maybe call it 6% for a loan. So then we, on that deal, we're not paying a discount. We're getting an attractive interest rate. Also, then it had room in the rents in terms of being able to raise them. So it's still a good opportunity. And I think actually it's probably there's more loan assumption deals available now than there were before, where everyone's thinking, oh, if this is a deal selling, what's your interest rate? Maybe the next buyer can take advantage of the low rate you have right now and not have to subject themselves to the higher rates today.
Yeah. So, you know, with that loan assumption, is there a way, have you found better ways to approach that concept? In multifamily and commercial spaces, it seems to be more common and people are a little bit more open to that concept. But sometimes I'm sure you're still in a situation where you have to educate people on it. Is there a different approach to it that you found most successful?
I think the only education, the education that we've done was really like on the, as the buyer was really pitching our experience where they realized like, okay, we can only sell this. So really the broker did, I think the education you're thinking of for us, assuming there was a broker on it where they're mm-hmm. looking at going, geez, if you need this high of a price to then also pay your prepayment penalty, really what we should do is go to these groups that also use Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac financing. And then I know those groups and we should just get in front of them and they can, you know, save that, you can save that $2 million. And so I think most of the education we've had to do was either on us pitching like our experience where we've done 30 or so agency loans with Fannie or Freddie. So then assuming one, like no problem, we know the process and likely the people that you use for your loan, we know them as well. Like we're probably using the same lender. So once you introduce us to your lender, we'll, you know, we already know them and this will go smoothly. And then I think that's as a buyer. And then we've sold some deals where people have assumed our loan. Like in the last year, I've sold 5 deals and I think 3 of those were loan assumption ones. But again, it was really more the broker we hired to sell was educating. You know, I think at that point we knew that was a good strategy because we could save on the prepayment penalty and the next buyer could take advantage of the loan. But then I think there was some education to some of the buyers on like, here would be the requirements from Fannie or Freddie to assume these loans. And if people are curious, you agency financing on multifamily properties and talking 5 units and greater over a $1 million loan balance, you need to have prior experience owning and managing, or at least being the asset manager already in that market of at least one building that's of that qual of that similar, a 5 unit with over $1 million loan. Like, so they, cause they, this isn't for your first loan. So then that's where we've had to, you know, tell some potential buyers on those deals. Like, I don't think you'd be able to assume this loan, you know, cause it's, they might have the down payment, but they don't in a high net worth, but this is their first deal. And then, you know, probably for your first deal, you're going to end up going like with a, you know, just a bank where that's going to be a recourse loan, but then you can build your track record of experience, which then would work for a non-recourse lender later.
You know, there's kind of quite a bit of a detail associated with these type of deals. Is that the type of information people can expect if they tune into your podcast, the Brenneman Blueprint?
Yeah, we really go in the weeds on doing it. You know, originally when I started it, I think, you know, I've a lot of the podcasts I listened to, they were very high level, you know, where it was just kind of talking about why investing is great, or we're talking more about residential properties, meaning like flipping houses or, you know, like doing like contract assignments. And so, you know, I wanted something that was more to do about commercial real estate and get the people that I was doing deals with on. And, you know, I had my lender on, he's done over $12 billion of financing, and my insurance agent and the other sort of peers of mine. And I had been living until last year in Chicago for the last 12 years. Now I live in Austin, Texas, but you know, a lot of the guests were from Chicago and doing large deals, and, you know, and it was very interesting even for me, because these were, a lot of these people were my friends or people I work with, but I learned just really a lot more details about what they had done and tips they were giving. Where one of my buddies, Ryan Cahalan, he was on, he has over, I said I had 200 something million. He has over $1 billion of multifamily. And he's, you know, he worked nights and weekends for like 20 years, basically building this up and then got to a point where he could quit his job and then had really hockey sticked up. But it was really just the track record relationships he put in, basically working what seemed like 2-3 jobs for a really long time. So that tip stuck with me. But yeah, this is more kind of the type of content we get into. I know, but, you know, we also do episodes where we try to focus on what passive investors should be looking at in a deal or in a potential partner or sponsor they could invest with. So I try to have a little bit of a variety. But yeah, a lot of times it ends up being real in the weed stuff like this, since this is what we do every day.
No, I appreciate you pointing that out. Again, if you want to learn a little bit more, look for Brenneman Blueprint in the podcast apps. But Brenneman.com is going to be a clickable link in the show notes. And if you like what we're talking about so far, do us a quick favor and share this with one of your investor friends. And if you're watching this on YouTube, give us a quick thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. So, Drew, I know that you have quite a bit of technology involved in your investment, especially coming from what you did previously. I'm guessing you're bringing a lot of that technology into the real estate world, bringing it forward. Can you talk a little bit about what you're using, how you're using it, and particularly maybe even not only finding the best opportunities to get into, but even the markets you're currently involved in?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've spent really a lot of time on our market selection. So we, you know, like I had said, I grew up in the Midwest, and, you know, those markets are nice. There's a lot to like about them. Like, they are very steady in terms of their growth. And then the occupancy is very high. Everyone seems to pay their rent. So there's a lot to like about those. But if, you know, the whole time I'm investing, I'm looking at people investing in Texas and in Arizona and Florida, and, you know, they were crushing it. You know, it obviously, this is, you know, those are much more volatile markets. So they're not having a great moment right now with all the oversupply they've had. But we spent a ton of time going through and really figuring out and examining like what leads to multifamily appreciation. And so we made a model that it has the 52 largest markets in it. And we pulled in as everything we could think of from a ton of different data sources. A lot of it's from the census, but just the population growth, the job growth, the income level, apartments that are under construction relative to the existing inventory, and then all these rate of change statistics off of those, where it's the population, it's just knowing like there's a lot of people there might not be too helpful, or that it's growing at 2%. But if the growth starts picking up, that's been really indicative. And then we figured out what was correlated with the growth, and then have then be able to kind of see what is projected for those same stats next year and the year after, and then project what, you know, what markets are poised to appreciate the most. And I mean, if people want to know, I mean, the takeaway on that is in the next couple of years, the Midwest markets for multifamily are at the top of our model, you know, that, and then I think Miami is the first like Sunbelt city to appear in this. And the reason for that, I think the, you know, a lot of these Sunbelt markets that got overbuilt and they have a lot of supply to work through. Whereas in the Midwest, things never got that frothy. You know, I was talking about how I refied money out of those deals, but, you know, I bought you know, they were at, you know, 4% interest rates, and the deals were being appraised at, you know, 6 caps. So there was still like a big spread there where, you know, things were upside down in the Sun Belt for a while, where people are buying deals that are a 3% cap rate, you know, and borrowing at 4%. So just banking on that growth. So that's one. And then one of the guys that I hired, he developed an underwriting model that he had built while he was working at a 50 plus billion dollar private equity shop. And when he was working there, he thought their model, even though they had done billions of dollars of deals, you know, wasn't too good. So he made his own in 2020. And then, you know, we've improved it since he came over to Brenneman Capital. And then from that, we made an investment database where you click a button in our model and then it moves it to a separate Excel file that we have as our database. And that is every deal we ever underwrote in it. And it pulls 900 different data points off of the model, just everything. So what would be nice is, let's say you're underwriting, let's say I'm in Austin. So let's say you're looking at 100 unit deals in Austin that are built, you know, around in the 1990s, and you want to compare how you're underwriting. You can go back and look, okay, what did I underwrite for insurance and repairs and all these things on all those deals? Because one thing that I suspect happens at a lot of investment shops is the deals they end up buying, you know, they pencil out in their model, but there's some reason that they didn't notice, like, oh, on that one, we thought the insurance would be lower, or we went a little more aggressive on repair and maintenance, and they're not exactly underwriting apples to apples. And then the one that kind of proceeding with, maybe it was just underwritten differently and wasn't all that different than the other deal. So we're able to, you know, really compare what we've underwritten, you know, and keep it standardized. And then also it's great, once we see like a deal sell, we can go update the price, update it, and see like, here's really where things are selling. Because one thing, if, you know, people are investing in deals themselves, they already know this, but oftentimes, let's say if a broker tells you the cap rate on a property, the real cap rate's actually lower. You know, they are using the broker expenses, which are very light, or maybe, you know, higher rents than are in place, assuming like, okay, we're going to use the market rents or something. So usually if like a broker says like, oh, it's going to sell for a 6% cap rate, when we underwrite it, usually it's like a 5.25, like a 5.25% cap rate. So then we have, you know, so we can, so we have the investment database, our market model, and then also we have just a lot of technology like to kind of use all that stuff. So we use Red IQ, which scrubs rent rolls and financials we would get on a deal that's for sale. And what I mean by that is we get it usually in a PDF form. So then a lot of people would spend a ton of time entering that into Excel. And what Red IQ does, it actually will convert the PDF to an Excel file, but also you can change the categories of the what the expenses are, or the rents, or the income category. So let's say an example, let's trash, for example, that expense. Some people put that in repairs and maintenance. Some people put that in contract services. Some people put it in utilities. Where you put it doesn't really matter, I would say, but it is that you would maybe underwrite every deal the same way. Like if you want to put in repairs and maintenance, but you got a financial where they put in utilities, you can make that move right there. We then hit a button in Red IQ, export it to Excel, and then you paste it into our model, and then it starts, and then our whole model is already populated. It just flows through the whole model. And then we start changing other variables, like what, you know, what our next year's rent's going to be, purchase price, the financing, all that. And then we spent a lot on data. We've, you know, subscribed to Moody's and CoStar, Yardi Matrix, a CRM to track all the deals all the broker type contacts, lenders, equity investors. So yeah, a lot. I know that's a long answer. So
no, I appreciate the detail, because I like to give people a glimpse into the amount of work that goes into some of this. Because I hate to give people the impression that they can just jump in and find something off of Craigslist.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is the second deal I bought was out of a newspaper ad. So pretty similar to maybe Craigslist. And, you know, that's fine if you're buying a duplex and it's your own money. But where this whole sort of all this investment started is, once you start taking outside money, or let's say you had to pick up an employee, like then everything really starts ramping up. Okay, you have an investors now. You need quarterly reporting. You need a pitch book. You know, when I was investing my own money, I didn't need any of that. You know, only my own money. You didn't need any of that stuff. I liked the deal. I liked the cash flow. I thought it was a good price based on the rents, and I bought it, you know. Mm-hmm. But then if you, yeah, if you want to start having investors and take this seriously, I mean, a lot of what I said, you know, a lot of shops maybe don't have some of the technology around the database or how their model's set up, but they all are, you know, they all have an investor relations portal and, you know, things like this. And that's, you know, and we have one too, you know, where we use Juniper Square as well. So then you can see all, if you're an investor of ours, you can see all your deals right there in your screen, all your distributions, you can pull your tax forms or K-1s or quarterly reports all in one spot. So, you know, that's, yeah, a lot of technology. And then as things get, you know, and, but it's the people I've hired too have helped a lot with it, you know, like that's been, it's been great to have, you know, have where I think a lot of the stuff I just rattled off, I mean, most of that I did not make myself. So.
You mentioned that the information that they provide, especially around the cap rate, is, it sounds like it's for the most part fiction versus any kind of an accurate picture. How many do you say, is it almost like an 80-20 rule? Is 80% of it, the ones that you review, are just way off, and there might be a small group that actually are good with the numbers? Like what would you say, how many deals do you have to review to find one that actually pencils out right?
Well, in terms of what the broker cap rates to what we think the cap rates are, it's 100%. They're never the same. You know, you get a broker. Yeah. You get a broker offering memo and they'll say the year one cap rate is, you know, whatever percent, but then they grow the rents 3% between today and year one. But it's like, wait, isn't year one right now? How did you grow the rents, you know, for tomorrow? Like that's, you didn't just re-rent the whole building or, and all their expenses are always aggressively low. But you need to understand it. Like a broker, their job is to put the property in the best light, get you to look at it as a buyer. And they're really serving more as like a sales function, also as an advisor. But at the end of the day, their job is sales. So they don't want to send the deal out and then be saying, hey, watch out, the taxes are going to be reassessed next year. A lot of buildings they're coming out really high. Like that's for the buyers to be thinking about and the owners. Like they want to put it in the best light and say, you decide on what the taxes are coming out. I talk to your people. I'm going to assume they don't change, you know, and then, but in terms of how many do you need to look at to buy one? I mean, a lot of people say the rule of thumb is, you know, you look at like 100, offer on 10, 3, get pretty close, buy one. I think as you know, we definitely are looking at more than 100 to buy one. I feel like it's probably, you know, at least when you call looking, like you review the email or like the materials on it, just a kind of a cursory overview. I mean, it's probably 1,000 to buy one, but you're not underwriting, you know, 900 of those deals are dying in your email inbox or kind of you ask, you learn how to kind of screen these deals. Just some of these metrics you'd never want to buy a larger deal off of. But if you bought a lot of the same type of property, you know roughly what per unit those would sell for or per foot or what gross rent multiplier, you know, things where you aren't factoring in the expenses. Because if you say, okay, the cap rate's great, but then you're like, well, are the expenses ridiculously low? So you end up developing these kind of pre-screening things where you go like, wow, that would break a record if that sells at that price, you know, a record for highest price. So then you go, okay, that one I'll just throw out right now. But yeah, so it's you have to look at a lot. And so that's what makes this, you know, sometimes I think to myself, and it's not always the case, but like I do think like a lot of the work we do in a way we sort of pay for ourselves, where we charge an acquisition fee and then a share of the profits if the returns are over a certain percentage. But when I look at our deals compared to even some of the deals that the investors we have bought on their own, our deals have all, I'm sure at some point one won't, but they've all gone very well. Our worst deal is a 16% return in our IRR, and our, I think our best was 30 something. So it's not, so if you're going to have that high of a bar, like, and do what we're doing, yeah, it's 500 to buy one. But if you're just trying to, I don't know, make 10% a year, like you probably could, you know, look at 25 and buy one. So it just depends what you're trying to do as well. We have set a pretty high bar for ourselves, and because we're also, you know, we're taking that outside money, so the returns need to be there to attract that capital. So,
yeah, I was questioning whether to even bring this up, but I recently saw, and I'm going to paraphrase this quite badly, but it was a quote with Grant Cardone. Have you seen him You probably know who he is at least.
Yes, I've been on the internet. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's hard, but he said it's something, hard to go on. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he said something recently about if it's on the MLS or if a brokerage is bringing it to him, of course it's a good deal.
Yeah, I saw that clip and I couldn't even begin to tell you what I think he meant by that. Like it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I think what he, you know, like, cause he's also in that clip, he's saying that if you're at the level I play at, it's the deal makes money. You know, it's like that. Well, it's like, yeah, it makes money, but if you make 4% a year on that deal, hey, guess what? You can make more than that in a money market in 2024. Like that doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense to me. So yeah, it didn't. I saw that clip, and that didn't really. What would I say about it? It didn't make any sense. Like, but I think I understood what he was getting at. But it didn't really, you know, just because it makes money doesn't mean it's a good deal. So
right.
I'm not sure what else to say. But yeah, I think you know what? A lot of these people that have, like Grant Cardone, like he's a marketing guy. Like, don't get it. He has a mark. He has, you know, if you're in automotive sales or so, like as a car salesman, like or work in home services, like we'll say you run a plumbing company, he has sales programs you can enroll in, and he's a great salesman. And so, I mean, he's marketing and sales, and you know, so he's great at selling his investment product, and will, you know, time will tell what those returns are. But I think he's just a very good salesman, and that's why he has, you know, the success he has. I mean, it's a skill he's developed.
You brought up earlier that you sold a number of properties over the past, I don't know if it was year or whatever.
Yeah,
what caused you to sell those?
Yeah, I was having this conversation actually with a investor of mine today who owns a couple deals without me. And they, you know, I think you need a reason to sell is what I was telling him, where in like the deal, one of the reasons it's like the deal feels topped out. So the rents are at market or even above market, let's say. And I'd say for two of the deals we sold, that's how we felt. It was like, when we go to re-rent these apartments next year, we might get less rent. Like, we can't believe how high we got the rents this year. And then also those deals, they were on the small side. So the last two deals we bought were, one was for 18 million, one was for 18 and a half million. And the ones we were selling were for 1.6 million, 2.6, 3.5, 7.5, like that size. So it's like, okay, they feel topped out. They're on the smaller side. Plus a couple of them, they had CapEx needs. Like, we're going to need to put some money back into this deal if we want to hold it another, let's say, 5 years. Because generally, I'm happy just holding deals. I mean, if we've promised, like, hey, this will be a 5-year hold, like, that's what we'll do. But a lot of our deals, we'll say it's a 10-year hold. And, you know, we might evaluate at that point and decide, hey, we should hold it longer. If we do that, we do a refi and return the initial capital along the way. But yeah, I've had deals that I've owned for 15 years now. And I think that's, you know, a lot of people are very IRR driven. You know, and that actually kind of stems from like institutional investors, and individuals are a lot different than institutional investors. So I think that's, you know, we focus on cash flow and building wealth and not, you know, and being tax efficient, not just selling stuff to put up a high IRR you can like post about, you know, on the internet or whatever. That's not how people like build wealth, really. And so, yeah, they were either small, old, peaked out rents. You know, those are really were the reasons. And also next year now it's this year, but in 2024 in Chicago, and all the deals we sold were in Chicago. And I guess too, we buy in Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Indianapolis. It's like our Midwest focus at this point. And then in the Sun Belt, Arizona and Texas. So then like in Chicago in particular, it's a tax reassessment year this year. So and they reassess every 3 years. So if you get a value you don't like on your initial pass for your tax assessment, your property, you're going to have a very hard time selling it till you get it reduced. And maybe that'll take a year to get a reduction. Or maybe when you go for your appeal, you'll be unsuccessful, and then you have to keep appealing next year and the year after. So two, you know, that's again with it potentially being peaked out value wise, as you look and go, gosh, those rents are really high. Like, relatively speaking to the comps, we're surprised we got that. Plus, we're going to get reassessed next year, might need some CapEx. It feels small. Like So you need a reason. I don't think it's, if you have no reason to sell, I mean, I think, and you got no great deal to put your money into next, I mean, I think values will be higher in a couple of years. So this, you know, you don't necessarily take that I sold some deals last year that it means you should sell. I still own, you know, 30 or so properties. Like, I'm not selling everything, but if, you know, it makes sense to sell, you know, if you have those reasons, I think.
Well, I'd be curious as to this, your answer to this. You know, people, you were talking about the passive income and people investing in your projects. Could you give us some guiding posts there? Like, what type of questions should somebody be asking a syndicator such as yourself to make sure it's a good fit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the number one thing people should be thinking about in terms of as a fit is really is take some time to think about what are your goals with passive investing. And, you know, most people like deeper than just kind of like, well, I want to make money or whatever. And because most, like, let's say most of the calls I do, and I do a lot of calls with passive investors. And if anyone wants to, you can book a call with me or someone on our team on our website. That's, you know, oftentimes the first step for somebody to invest with us. And most 9 out of 10 times, they say like their goal is cash flow. But I feel like the reason is they don't really know what else to say. Like, they don't understand how the tax benefits are very complicated, you know, to, unless you're actually looking at a partnership tax return, it's not easy to understand what's going on. And so they say cash flow, but then you talk to them and it's like they have very high incomes. They don't actually need more like money today in terms of like cash flow. They're trying to find a way to diversify and build wealth and maybe save on taxes or be, you know, tax efficient where they don't, you know, it's not like a mutual fund where they're trading your, you know, selling the stocks in and out, where this, you know, we could choose to hold it for 10 years and then sell and then do a 1031 tax deferred exchange and keep waiting. I've done now probably 6 or so 1031s and one of them is now we're on the third one. So, you know, we bought something, and then we did a 1031 to a new deal, then we sold that, then did a 1031 to two other deals. And so you have these other things you could be doing, but it's like, it's probably for less than half really the motivating factor is cash flow. It's really, you know, find out what you're investing for and then try to find deals that match up with that to stick on the cash flow idea. I know. So if someone is interested in cash flow, then you should not invest in development deals because those don't have any cash flow. You know, you build it and then you sell it typically, and there's no cash flow while you're building because there's no rents coming in. And then renovation deals you should not invest in because you're going to buy a property and maybe it's cash flowing then, but now you're going to be emptying out units and then renovating them. So there's going to be minimal cash flow. And I have saw deals where people are being paid cash flow and it's a renovation deal, but the cash flow you're being paid is actually the equity they raised and they're just paying it back to you. Like, that's a common syndicator move is, you know, okay, we need $2 million to close the property, let's say, but let's raise $3 million and then we'll pay the $1 million out as we're renovating these units. And then it's like we had cash flow. So I think that's, you know, just know like there's not actually cash flow being generated. I mean, usually like if you're renovating units one at a time and it's a large property, there still will be cash flow. But I'm talking like on a where they're taking a lot of units down to renovate. So yeah, I think matching up what your goals are, I think is number one. And then yeah, what to look for. I mean, yeah, you want somebody that has the experience of doing this, where I think a lot of people got started in like 2019, 2020 and, you know, maybe took a course or something and are doing it now. And so I think ideally, yeah, you want somebody who's been doing it, I think, longer, has, you know, experience of things not going right, you know, where it hasn't just been like straight up like it has been in recent times until very recently when things stopped going straight up. And I think that, like, I think that's, you know, that's important, you know, just really looking at their experience, but experience in doing what this deal they're proposing is, where it might, you know, I've been doing real estate since 2005, but it's been mostly multifamily. So if I decide to do a hotel, which I've never done before, like I would approach that with caution if I was an investor. Like I have a lot of experience, but not in this. So if I was looking at that as a passive investor, I'd say, like, are you bringing on a partner, or how do you know how to do this hotel? You've never done it. So yeah, I think I would start there, you know, kind of even because before looking at the deal, where that's, you know, the goals, the spot, the track record, you know, is there, are they trustworthy, you know, before, I think the deal probably be the third thing to look at, where, you know, the deal could be great, but if you don't really think the sponsor has the experience or they're trustworthy or it doesn't match up with your goals, like who cares how great the deal looks on paper?
Well, you know, this has been a great conversation and there's so much information that you can garner for Brenham and his team. I'm going to send everybody to your website again, but more importantly, if you're interested in this type of investing, you might want to check out Brenneman Blueprint, the podcast, as well as Brenneman.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes again. But Drew, you know, I think we could keep going on and on. I have a million other questions for you. But before we transition into the rapid fire questions, is there a question or concept you think we should have covered here up to this point?
No, I think, yeah, this has been great. And I think no one's ever asked me about Grant Cardone before, but yeah, that's been, but I did see that clip so that I was like, I can see where he's going with this, but it just sounds bad the way he's putting it out. Where like, if, you know, so that was funny to think about, but yeah, this was great. Yeah. A lot of things I haven't been asked about before. So this was fun.
Well, if you're ready, we'll just jump into some rapid fire questions and learn a little bit more about you and your business.
Sounds good.
What lie do real estate investors tell themselves and sometimes to others?
I think I started touching that, but I didn't really go like fully into it. I think the lie is, you know, that the IRR is the best metric. You know, I think so one of the deals I bought in Chicago, just for example, was from a guy whose dad had bought like 50 duplexes back in like the 1970s. In the Lincoln Park neighborhood, and people aren't familiar with Chicago, like that neighborhood is as nice as it gets in Chicago. And a duplex there now is worth $1 million. And he was buying them when they were 10, 20 grand. So, you know, nowadays it seems like how people invest is you would want to put up a high IRR and then like promote it somewhere and raise money and do all these things. And I mean, this guy made, you know, what's the math on that? Not including cash flow, you know, $50 million on paper if he never did any other deals. And so I think as an individual investor, I think the IRR is not the end all be all metric. And I don't think there is one. So there's no like punchline is like, this is actually the metric. But like IRR, really the reason people focus on that. And I think it's driven from institutional investors, pension funds. Like they are, most of those investors, like a pension fund, they're tax exempt. So they have the luxury of going like, we just want the highest return over a given period of time. We don't care about taxes or even if there's cash flow, like we just want the highest return, you know, risk adjusted. So they're not necessarily investing in the riskiest deals, but we just want the highest return. We don't care when the cash flows hit. We just want the highest IRR. Where an individual, I mean, if your number one goal was cash flow, like then that's, to me, should trump IRR. Or if you're trying to build wealth, equity multiple would be a better metric. Or, and then also if you're a taxpayer, like every individual, like looking at your returns after tax would be more useful potentially as well. So I think the lie is, to sum it up, is that the IRR is the best metric.
Do you have a book recommendation or what are you reading right now?
Yeah, as far as real estate books, I think Investing in Real Estate by Gary Eldred is the book that I'd say did the most for me. That was the book where I had sort of a light bulb moment when I was in high school about real estate investing. And he broke it down very simply. So if someone's thinking about learning about how does this work, I'd recommend it, because me as a 16-year-old kind of, you know, figured out how it worked at that point reading that book. So.
If you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of advice, what would that be?
I think it would be over-prepared. You know, try to get as many moves ahead as possible. You know, it's something I figured out kind of once I started doing these larger deals, there was a lot more going on. So I started developing that habit, but nobody really told me to. So now I have the luxury of looking back and knowing the importance of it. But yeah, if I'm doing a deal with somebody, I'm always trying to be one move ahead. If I was going to buy a building from you, Jack, I'll draft the purchase agreement. Don't waste your money on the attorney. Like, cause I want to have all my terms in it. And then if you send it back to me and if it's on a Friday, I'm going to read it over the weekend. you know, I want to be ahead of the game for when my attorney looks at it on Monday or whatever. My attorney is as hardcore as I am. He would work on it on the weekend, but I want to be ahead of the game. I don't want to be like, okay, you know, why didn't I think of that, you know, like a month later? Like, I want to have thought of that ahead and be trying to think as many moves ahead as possible. So, and that's been helpful as the deals have gotten more complicated too.
Sure. What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented in your business to have a direct time-saving impact?
I think, so like I think I had mentioned that I had done about 40 deals, you know, purchases, I guess more if you include the sales. But what's one thing that has saved me a lot of time is like I have saved all the files, everything for every deal. It's actually saved the exact same way. I use Dropbox. So on Dropbox, but just on your computer, a folder for every deal. And inside of that, the folder structure is the exact same for every single deal. And then where things are saved is the same on every deal. Like I can find, if you wanted a survey from 15 years ago on that deal I was talking about, I'd be able to find it in 10 seconds because it's literally in the same spot. You know, that property development before closing survey, like it's the same, and it should say acquisitions, but I started out doing at a development shop, so then it says development. But so that's been, and we also, the file naming convention is the same with the date written a certain way. So yeah, if you work for me, you know, I'm sure everyone loves this where it's like you got to save it in this spot. But it has saved me a ton of time, because if I ever need, we had a thing where somebody was confused on the square footage, or is our insurance company trying to tell us we had the wrong square footage and needs to raise the total annual premium. And I pulled five different things proving here's the square footage because of, you know, and it took me like 5 minutes, you know, with this system. So I'd recommend that, you know, if you can do it at the start, you'd save yourself some time. I did at some point, I was at like 10 deals. Like I need to reorganize all this and spent, you know, a week on getting it all set up and everything saved down, but it's been smooth ever since.
No, that's a great tip. Again, Brenneman.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. Really appreciate your time, Drew. It was great chatting with you here tonight.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.